Friends, here's a little something different on this, the eve of Father's Day. As I'm now going to introduce you, for those indeed who know Mike Scanlon, you know that he is the author of the book Rolling Up the Rug, which is about Michael's Irish-American upbringing. And he's going to tell us about the time when he and his father visited Ireland together. And it was the first time that his father, Gus Scanlon, returned to Ireland after 34 years in America. The story has been published internationally, first here by Irish Central, irishcentral.com. Then it was picked up by the Irish Post in London and England. And well, here's Mike with his own story.
After 3 decades in America, my father returned to Ireland to bring me on my first trip home. It was to be his final journey back to the Emerald Isle. Cheers and applause burst out as the Aer Lingus 707 touches down in Dublin International Airport on that summer's afternoon in 1961. My father, sitting next to me, turns, winks, reaches out and shakes my hand and says, "I'm home again, Mick. First time after 34 years in America." Aunt Etta and Uncle Bertie Carroll, my father's sister and her husband, greet Pop and me with hugs and tears and laughter, and off we go into the golden sunlight to Peacock House, their two-story white stone home with a little glass greenhouse in the back garden in the town of Balbriggan, just outside Dublin. Aunt Etta, with smiles and cheer, introduces me to my older first cousin, Morris, and to her daughters, Amelia, Rosemary, Eileen, and Etta, ages 26 through 16. I'm 22 years old, I'm fresh out of college, and I have never seen or spoken to these cousins from the day I was born. And now here they are, all shining, pink-cheeked and smiling, reaching out their hands and speaking in soft, lovely Irish accents, "How do you do, Michael? And welcome to Ireland." I feel a surprising instant bond and familiarity with these pretty young women, mixed with an intriguing sense of mystery. Louisa May Alcott's book, Little Women, comes to my mind, and as I mention this to them, they all laugh and they say, "Ah, sure, we know that book backwards." We play phonograph records, we dance, sing songs by the piano. I am smitten with all of them. I can't believe I am already plotting my immediate return to Ireland after our 3-week visit is over. The next morning, while my father sleeps, Aunt Etta stands over the kitchen table and places breakfast in front of me. "Here's some rashers and bangers and fried eggs for you and toasted brown bread and a nice gob of butter," she says. She then speaks of my father. "Oh, I remember that night. The black and tans, those terrible British rowdies, came storming into our house in County Sligo and roused your father and our brother Pat out of their beds and then dragged them down to the road to dig some sort of a ditch. They held guns over the lads' heads the whole time. Well, it wasn't too long after that when your father, our dear Gustin, announced he was leaving for America. And so at age 22, in 1928, your father did just that. He left home, he got on that boat to New York City, and he never came back until now. That afternoon, my cousins take me for a stroll along the nearby Strand. Hoping to impress these female beauties, I become the brazen Yank. I tell them of my prowess riding waves, which I learned from summer days at New York's Rockaway Beach. I saunter out onto the jetty, strip off my shirt, and in my summer shorts, I leap into the ocean, only to let out a blood-curdling, howling roar from the shocking ice-cold water of the Irish Sea. The girls on shore burst into gales of laughter, enjoying the proper comeuppance of their swaggering Yank cousin. After a few days spent in Dublin, my father and I board the train to Sligo and are greeted at the station by my father's younger brother, Michael, and his two sisters, Kathleen and Marianne. No sooner had Marianne hugged her brother than she laments, "God help us, Gus. Won't it be a terrible day when you'll be leaving us again just too soon?" The old home lies near the Holy Well, 3 miles from Sligo town. My father walks me up a lane, and we stand under a sullen Irish sky in the high, dry grass among the fallen stones of the old country farmhouse where he was born and raised. He is quiet for a long time. Does he have thoughts of what might have been? Is he glad he left Ireland? Or does he have regret about not staying here among the fields of his ancestors? He leads me down a deserted dirt road. "Do you see that crossroads there, Mick?" Hughes points. "Oh, the life that used to be had there of a Sunday morning after Mass, the boys and the girls and the laughter and the flipping of coins and the gambling, and my own father among them. Those were good times, and all gone." As a boy, I remember my father always loved to sing the Lakes of Sligo. "The Holy Well I bid adieu to Hazelwood and Cairns too, and Tubernock, that splendid view which adorns the Lakes of Sligo." I am struck by the beauty of this land, the deep green grass on the sloping hills, as we make our way to the Lake Isle of Inishree, made famous by W.B. Yeats. And here, under the great blue Sligo sky and beside the silver clear water, one could indeed feel peace come dropping slow. Afterwards, we visit Drumcliff Churchyard, and I snap a picture of my father by the poet's tombstone with the epitaph, "Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horsemen pass by." We stop by a thatched cottage of a very old woman, a family friend, and as she sits in her rocking chair by the fire, she begins to silently weep as she remembers my father as a boy picking potatoes in her field. "Ah, never one so full of song as yourself," she whispers. My father stares into the fire without a word. What is he thinking? Of the swift passage of time, of parents long gone. It comes time to travel the 22 miles to visit my mother's home in County Leitrim. Mom had returned to Ireland the year before, her first time in 35 years. She helped organize a charter plane to Ireland in our Bronx parish of Sacred Heart in Highbridge, and she was awarded a free trip for her efforts. And so she encouraged my father and me to visit the following year. My mother, Mamie Gallagher, was the oldest of five, and at age 16, her parents reluctantly decided she was old enough to leave home. They hoped she would make a better life for herself with her cousins, two nurses in New York City. She recounted, "I'll never forget that gray day in 1927 as I stood on the quay in County Derry saying goodbye. And what I remember most was my mother could not stop crying." Perhaps her mother, Kate, then only in her mid-40s, realized only too well what her departing daughter did not. They would never lay eyes on one another again. Mom recalled, "I was seasick the entire trip across the Atlantic." Though only 16, she knew her journey carried an important mission, to send money back home to bring her brother and sister to join her in America. Never one to feel self-pity. She did confess once. I cried myself to sleep every night for that first year in America. Like so many thousands of others who left Ireland in those years in the 1920s, the young left their homes, sailed for America, started families of their own, and simply could not afford to return. We meet my mother's brother, Jim, and his wife, Margaret, and their 10 children, who live not far from the town of Bundoran. Uncle Jim points with pride to the land he inherited from his father. That field over there, he says, lies in Donegal, and the field right next to it is in Leitrim. He says this with a hearty greeting, as if he knew us all his life, even though we've only just met for the first time. My Uncle Jim is an accordionist, my father an Irish fiddler, and so after the local pub closes that first night, the pub owner invites a group of us to the back room where the pints keep flowing, and Pop and Uncle Jim strike up the music playing jigs and reels and hornpipes and waltzes. The evening of song and rollicking Irish music and lively banter goes far into the night, with Pop on his fiddle and Uncle Jim on his accordion, and ending with the most improbable, "That's why the lady is a tramp." That night, and for each night of our visit, my father and I sleep under a thatched roof under the stars in the same bedroom where my mother was born 50 years before. The next day, a Saturday, we make the rounds meeting my mother's cousins. In every home, without fail, I take note of the portrait of the newly elected President John F. Kennedy, right next to a print of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. We visit a cottage of an older cousin, Katie Ruddy, and her elderly cousin dozes in his chair in the corner. And Katie insists we take a chicken back with us to Uncle Jim's. So out she goes to the yard, where her chickens are gamboling about. And as casual as if she was shelling peas, she continues chatting, and then spying an especially plump chicken, she grabs hold, traps it between her legs, bends its neck over, and with a big knife slices its throat until the blood comes pouring out. After letting a good bit of the blood drain, she wraps the now dead chicken in a newspaper, and she hands it to me, saying, "Give this to your Aunt Margaret and Uncle Jim, and enjoy a good Sunday dinner tomorrow." And sure enough, the next day, here's the chicken, all brown and crisp and delicious to eat. And I can tell you, for a boy like myself, brought up on the concrete streets of New York City, it was an amazing sight to behold. We returned to Dublin to catch our flight home. I welcome the chance to visit the four little women again, who take me off to a local dance one last time. The next morning, amidst laughter, tears, and farewells, we promise to return to Ireland soon. Pop tries to stay stoic. He shakes hands all around, but cannot bring himself to utter his final farewell. And I have to propel him out the door so as not to miss our flight. Arriving in New York, Mom hands me a letter from the U.S. Draft Board. "Greetings. You are ordered to report for your physical. My plans to go back to Ireland are now thwarted. For the next 3.5 years, I will serve as an officer in the United States Navy." My mother would live a long life and return to Ireland 15 years later when my brother and his wife bought a grand house in County Westmeath. My father died 12 years after our trip, and he never made it back. They were both very, very proud Americans, but always remained Irish to the backbone till the end. My parents are long gone now, as are my aunts and uncles. But that first trip to Ireland lives on within me. It gave me my first real glimpse into where I came from and to the people who came before me and helped to shape me. I came to appreciate not only the lives of my mother and father, but the lives of the warm-hearted country Irish people who generation upon generation have enriched America with so many of their sons and daughters.
Mike Scanlon, that was really good. It would actually have been somewhat better. It would have been somewhat better if we actually got it through the first time. But you know,
you know what it is, Adrian.
Yeah.
I'm calling you from deep in the woods of Columbia County, New York. You know, I retreated up here. At the start of the pandemic, and the reception up here with the phone, I'm afraid, doesn't always work,
yeah,
and I'm sorry that it got interrupted.
No, that's, again, we go back more than 50 years, and actually you were, indeed, as my close friend at the time, you helped get this program off the ground. And I've heard so many stories about your parents, about, their moving from Highbridge to Rockaway. But even there was one common strain, and that was they were actually lively party people. They love to give parties and to attend parties. Can you maybe describe some of those, the house parties, and indeed, well covered, by the way, in your book, Rolling Up the Rug?
Well, you know, Adrian, as I mentioned in the story I read about my father and I going to Ireland, my father was an Irish fiddler, and my mother sang Irish songs in a beautiful, lilting voice, I should say. And they went to many parties, and they were usually the life of the party, but they also threw a lot of parties themselves. And when I think back on my parents and the apartment in the Highbridge section of the Bronx where they raised my brother and my sister and me all those years ago, I think mostly about those parties. I mean, if you can imagine, it's a Saturday morning in the early 1950s, and Mom and Pop begin pushing the couch and the chairs and the tables from the living room, and they stuff them into the bedroom. And then getting down on their knees in the living room, they start the ritual that truly signals a night of music and dancing, and that is the two of them start rolling up the rug. And that would indicate to my 10-year-old self that a party was coming up that night. Yeah. And they hoist this big, well-worn maroon pattern rug, I remember it so well, and they banish it to the bedroom for the night. And then they would rim the bare living room with bridge chairs that they rented for the occasion. And then the room itself actually would transform into a tiny dance hall. And then my mother would go out and buy a big juicy ham and salads and coleslaw and cold cuts from the German delicatessen, and at the Jewish bakery she'd buy rye bread and marble cake and cookies. And then one particular time I remember the Highbridge beer distributor sent over a keg of beer, and the keg was carried up the 5 flight of stairs and was put into the kitchen sink with a spigot attached for the pouring, and that was there beside bottles of a very popular brand of whiskey called Four Roses and Canadian Club, and they would be there to be mixed with ginger ale often enough for highballs. And then in the evening, the men and the women would arrive. Now, most of the people that were friends of my mother and father in those days were from the west of Ireland, from counties like Galway and Mayo and Sligo and Clare, Leitrim, Donegal, Roscommon, Longford, Cavan, Cork, and Kerry. And when these Irish people came to a house party, you know, this was, they didn't come casual. They got dressed to the nines, and I remember the women would come in all perfumed and powdered and in lovely dresses, sometimes dotted with rhinestones, and the men had beautiful white starched shirts with wide ties, and they would shake your hand with these big laboring man's hands and take their seats, while my Uncle John, who was a bartender at the local saloon, he would serve the drinks. And, of course, before long, then the music would start with my father sitting there with his red and yellow bow tie. And he sat next to a man named Mike Ryan, who was an accordionist, and they would strike up the first dance of the evening. And that first dance, I'm sure you know, Adrian, so well from your experience as a musician, was the Stack of Barley. And as soon as they heard that sound, they would be up on their feet, the people, and on our little improvised dance floor, they would swing each other, laughing and dancing and whooping, and they would stomp the bare floor of our living room, and my father's elbow would be gyrating widely on the fiddle, you know, his left foot tapping the floor, and then the Stack of Barley would segue into the Highland Fling, and then the hopped-up version of the Verse of Vienna, and then sometimes they would do set dances and old-time waltzes. And I'll never forget one night, my Aunt Margaret is in a pink satin dress with her curly blonde hair piled high on her head, and she led the entire crowd around every room of our apartment in a conga line that went on forever. I mean, these people really, really knew how to have fun.
Michael, and I then, just want to ask you about, as you describe, you know, all, you know, of the dances and the clip-clopping to the Stack of Barley. What about the neighbors downstairs? Were they
I know. We had Jewish neighbors, the Shapiro family, and there has to be a special place in heaven for that family, because I do remember my mother apologizing to Mr. Shapiro after one of these nights, and he was a guy who was smoking a big cigar, and he said, Well, we kind of enjoyed the Irish music. We kind of enjoyed it. So we took that, you know, right away as permission. And they just put up with it. And who knows, maybe they did enjoy the Irish music, you know. But I have heard from so many other people since I wrote this book that I used to think we were unique in having these house parties. But so many people have chimed in and talked about how all over the city in those years, which was a very Irish city, you know, in the 40s and 50s, there were parties like this going on all the time, you know.
My guest, of course, Mike Scanlon, author, writer. And I let me just ask you, though, about that transition from Highbridge in the Bronx to Rockaway, where, indeed, I got to know, and many, you know, of the Irish who were transplants from the Bronx, Rockaway, well, it became known as the Irish Riviera. What was the main attraction, and how did those people, all of them, how did they wind up in Rockaway versus Long Beach or, you know, coastal area?
Well, you know, first of all, Rockaway, you know, was the place that we went in the summertime. You know, some people, some Irish families chose to go to the Catskills up at East Durham, the places like Gavin's.
Yeah.
But we went up to East Durham one summer, I vividly remember. But for the most part, Rockaway became the place where we would go when my father got his vacation. And people from all over the city, you know, from other neighborhoods like Inwood and Washington Heights in Manhattan, Woodside and Sunnyside, and Bay Ridge and Brooklyn, they would all stream down to Rockaway for the 2 or 3 weeks that the vacation time would come. And so Rockaway became sort of a familiar place to us. And then in the late 60s and 70s, Highbridge started really to turn. And it was a time when drugs really started infesting the city. And muggings were starting to take place. And this lovely neighborhood went down. And people looked for a different place to live. And my family pulled up stakes and moved to Rockaway. And Rockaway, though, in those days, of course, was famous. And this was particularly, I remember, as a young lad, I would say, like when I was before even I was 10 years old, they had a place called Irish Town, which was at 103rd Street. And this was like an amazing place. It was you know, one Irish bar after the other. It was kind of like the Old West almost, and the music would be spilling out from the Leitrim House or the Sligo House or the Dublin House, and people would be there with their sunburns from the beach and carrying a glass and listening to the music, the Irish music, and a mixture of American top hits too. And Rockaway just was this fantastic place, and still is, of course, in many ways.
Yeah.
But Irish Town had faded by the time, I would say, by the mid-50s. It kind of like faded out. But it was a very unique place at one time.
Michael,
and,
sorry.
And then my mother and father ended up spending, you know, my mother lived in Rockaway for 27 years of her life, the last 27 years of her life, and found a community there, much like the community that was in Highbridge.
Mike, time is running against us, but I do, you know, want to, you know, to thank you for bringing us the flavor not only of, you know, the Irish and growing up in Highbridge and in Rockaway, but also bringing us that kind of tribute to fathers. I think a lot of us, a lot of people would be able to relate to that.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring you back and a lot of our listeners back, indeed, to the 50s in Rockaway. And in the Mayor House, you would have Mickey Carton and so many other musicians, but Mickey in particular. We took up a tune here, which we'll end on, and it's called The Irish Washwoman. Mike?
Again, thank you, Adrian, and happy Father's Day to you.
And to you, good self as well.
Good father that you are. God bless you.
Thank you. The book written by Mike Scanlon is called Rolling Up the Rug, and it is a bestseller, not only in the United States, but in Ireland, in England, and Rolling Up the Rug,